Please be seated. Good morning. We welcome today students from La Follette High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming today. You may be seated. We have students from Faith Christian School. Would they stand, please? You might be seated too, please. And we have students from Lakeshore Technical College. Would they stand? Thank you for coming today. We have an overflow crowd, and we have students who are in room 411 south of the Capitol, and we cannot see them, but they can see us. So would the Fort Atkinson High School students please stand quietly? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have loyal public school students. Would they please stand?
Are they upstairs too?
They are upstairs too, and they may be seated. Thank you. And finally, we have Monroe High School students in room 411 South, and they may be seated. First, they have to stand. Now they can be seated. We want to thank all these students for coming today. Right after this oral argument, we will have a justice of the court, namely Justice Butler, in the courtroom making a presentation to the students here. And Justice Prosser will make the presentation to the students in 411 South. The presentations are about the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case we are about to hear. Many of the students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come, listen to an oral argument. If they agree, then they are given briefs of the case that we're about to hear and may engage in outside activities regarding that case. And then the last step in the program is to speak with a justice. So we are very pleased with this program. Everyone is invited to stay in the courtroom or go to 411 South for the presentation. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, raise your hand and we will give it to you. Okay. Well, we've met you all. Let me introduce the court to you. Starting on my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rokensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks.
Well done.
I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. And today is a very special day because it is our last argument as scheduled, and the court hopes it remains that way. Until the court recesses on June 30th. And we want to recognize Justice Butler. We're proud to have served with him. His presence gives honor to this institution. Lewis, your friend and colleague, thank you. Thank you for your dedication.
thank you all very much. And let me, this was unexpected. I just want to recognize a couple of people who are here in the courtroom. First of all, I see my daughter sitting in the back row, Jessica Butler. Is Brett here? Brett Eckstein? Brett, my first clerk here at the court. And I want to thank you for your service to the court and to me. Jake Whitwer, who was my law clerk last year, and I want to thank you for your service as well. Nancy Marcus is my current law clerk. I've had some very outstanding clerks, as you may all suspect. We work very closely with our clerks here, and it's the type of relationship when you're working as a justice. You basically have seven people you can communicate with, maybe eight. Your legal assistant, your clerk, and your colleagues. You can't talk to anybody else about the cases. So it's a very special relationship. Joyce Doze was my longtime legal assistant, and Joyce is sitting right over here. And I want to thank you for all of your help and service to the court. My current assistant is Rita Lord, who's sitting back over here. And I want to thank her. I've got three current interns in the court here. David Moore. Where's David? Lydia Salzeder. Where's Lydia? She's running late, okay. And Elizabeth Soltis. She's not here right now. All right. And I appreciate all of their help throughout my tenure here on the court. And it's been an honor to have served with my colleagues. I have said many times, and I will continue to say, that we have an outstanding Supreme Court. And I'm proud to have worked with my colleagues. Thank you all very much. I would also be remiss. I would also be remiss if I didn't acknowledge our wonderful marshal here, Tina Nodolf, who has provided wonderful service through the years. And my good friend from the Court of Appeals, Judge Paul Higginbotham, who's sitting here in the first row. There are a number of other people out here, and I'm going to miss some, so if I do, please forgive me. But I see Liz here from Justice Crook's chambers, and I see who else is out here?
Sherry.
Yeah, Sherry and Ingrid, Patty, Denise. I see Julie Rich from the commissioner's office here in court. David Runke is back here as well. And I'm sure I'm missing, and please, I apologize if I don't call on everyone. There is also the other
recognize
clerks.
Nancy Cobb.
Where's Nancy? I didn't see there's Nancy. Nancy Cobb from the commissioner's office. I see a number of the clerks here as well for the other justices. And they work well together. They work for each individual justice, but they always work. They often work well as a team as well. So I appreciate all their service. So with that, I think it's time that we move to the today's business, which is the argument that's before the court.
You want me to call the case?
Thank you all very much.
All right. I can handle that. 06AP1566, the state of Dale Otto versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, Inc. Representing Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin is Michael Van Sicklin. Counsel, you may proceed.
It's a hard transition going from a standing ovation to talking about default judgments. And before I introduce myself and talk about the case, I would note that the one thing that the Otto's counsel and I agree on is our admiration for Justice Butler, and we do echo and share the remarks and the standing ovation just made.
Thank you.
I'm Mike Van Sicklin of the Madison office of Foley & Lardner. With me today is my colleague, Bree Gross-Wilde. It's our pleasure to represent the defendant, appellant petitioner, Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, which I'm going to refer to as PIC. This case presents an interesting issue of first impression in Wisconsin about default judgment. It's a first impression because of the unusual factual and procedural circumstances within which it arises. As lawyers, we're all familiar with the normal competing maxims of a deadline's a deadline, you got to make it, and every person deserves their day in court, and default's disfavored. So what's unusual about this case? And I want to talk briefly about the very unusual three or four factual and procedural circumstances. Then I want to talk about the law, and in particular, whether or not Wisconsin's direct action statute makes a difference or how it should be taken into account. Here,
counsel, would you state for me what the issues are in this case?
I think the narrow issue, Your Honor, is did the timely answer to the amended complaint filed on behalf of the health care providers, does that inure to the benefit of PIC? And what is the proper remedy for default in a situation like this where you have co-defendants, several of whom are the primary defendants in the sense of their behavior is the issue in the case, whether or not they were negligent, and the defaulting defendant is a dependent or conditional party in terms of its liability. It can only be found liable if there was negligence by its insured.
Just again, in terms of really focusing, are you challenging or addressing the issue of excusable neglect?
Nope. There was as this case progressed up through the trial court and the Court of Appeals, we did contest whether there was a default at all, whether if there was a default, it was excusable, whether there was prejudice, and if so, is that a separate factor that should be taken into account? And throughout, in a separate set of briefings and oral argument in both the trial court, and we raised it again in the Court of Appeals, the present issue about the unusual circumstances of the insured and insurer where you have dependent liability. And the very unique body of case law and treatise law that we find throughout the country on this particular issue.
Okay.
That's what I'm focusing on.
Allow me one more push, if I may. So I understand, and I know what went on below and in the Court of Appeals, and as you just gave your litany in response, you indicated that below you contested whether there was a default at all, whether it was excusable, whether there was prejudice or you needed prejudice. None of those issues are being argued here today. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so you are not arguing that the court inappropriately granted an order for default judgment. Rather, your argument is, what is the effect and scope of that order for default judgment?
Essentially, the judgment part is the only part I trip on your question.
Yes, I understand that.
We aren't contesting that PIC was found to have defaulted.
Yeah.
And that the default was an excuse. The question is whether a default judgment is the proper remedy here.
Okay, so you would use the term default judgment to mean and encompass the judgment that was entered in the amount of in excess of $900,000. That's what you're referring to?
Correct.
So what's the remedy after the defendant defaults, in your opinion? We agree that there's a default. We agree it can't be open on excusable neglect. So what remedy are you looking for?
In all the courts and other jurisdictions which have looked at this, they look at, I guess there's really two steps to that, Your Honor. One is whether there should be any consequences at all. That's the common defense rule, the dependent liability cases. in the Furrow line of cases. And there, the timely defense, which joined issue on everything in this case, inures to the benefit of the non-answering defendant, here Pick.
And that relates to your opening statement that the issue, this was in response to Justice Bradley, that the defendant's answer, that the other defendant's timely answer inured to Pick's benefit. Therefore, Pick was not really in default because there was an answer and therefore no consequences.
Well,
is that your argument?
Yes and no.
Okay.
It's in default in the sense that its lawyer did not submit a timely answer on its behalf. Okay. And while the issue of whether the reasons for that constitute excusable neglect or not, we're past that point here. The question here is whether entering a default judgment against Pick, where issue has been joined in the answer of the timely defendants, is appropriate.
Common defense rule.
Right.
Okay. What's your second one?
That is the issue, I think.
Well, that's really the issue. But courts have held that where you have dependent liability, in this case, and there's different contexts where this arises. It arises in respondeat superior, where you have employee and employer. It's where you have a lawsuit on a loan with a guarantee, where you sue the borrower and the guarantor. You have the parental situation where you sue the minor and the dad, you know, in Nevada for being, you know, dependently liable.
Counsel,
all those contexts are the same.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. The cases from other jurisdictions, I don't find very persuasive. And the reason that I don't is because we have a direct action statute in Wisconsin. And it's, at least it's my understanding that that's really unusual across the country. Isn't that a significant distinction? And therefore, shouldn't we forget about the cases from other jurisdictions and just look at Wisconsin cases?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I don't think, here's why. And that is, there are two states with exactly similar direct actions, Louisiana and ours. And there's some that have kind of modified versions of it. But the direct action statute isn't really germane to this issue. Here, the Ottos had a choice under our direct action statute to sue just the health care providers, just their insurer, or both. And they elected on their own to sue both. And if there had been the context where they sued only the insurance company, my client, Pick, and there hadn't been any answer at all, then you wouldn't have the whole issue about potentially different outcomes, a timely answer joining issue, whether the timely answer inured to the benefit. There is absolutely no suggestion in any of the cases dealing with a direct action statute that it changes the fundamental relationship between insured and insurer. The insurer's liability is dependent on the insured being found negligent. And we quoted Couch in our briefs on insurance, where that was made very clear that that's the position. In order to establish under a direct action statute, this is at page 13 and 14 of our opening brief, that the insurer is liable, you have to first establish the liability of its insured.
Counsel, I don't think that's a correct statement of the law. I don't think that in order to find the insurance company liable, you have to first find the defendant liable.
I don't know if you have to first find it, but you can't. All of the cases talk about, from every other jurisdiction in this country, state and federal, talk about you can't be left in the situation we have here where you have sort of inconsistent outcomes of the two groups of defendants. You have those who are alleged to have been negligent, the health care providers, who by a stipulation that counsel signed and the court entered an order are found their answer denying all aspects of negligence stands, and that there's no finding of negligence as to them, whereas you have the co-defendant whose liability is contingent.
Now, the reason I stopped you is the interchange of your language between liability and negligence. You first made the comment, and that's where I stopped you, that the insurer cannot be found liable if, and I'll paraphrase it a bit, if the insured is not liable. That's where I stopped you, because I think that's where the direct action statute informs the discussion. Hypothetical, auto accident, and it's a hypothetical, so I'll change the, let's take the law of Wisconsin, auto accident. The plaintiff sues in a direct action against the insured in year two. 3-year statute of limitations. The plaintiff sues, brings in the insured in year four. And then, since the statute of limitations has run as to the insured, can the insured ever be liable?
I'm not sure I exactly follow the context here, but
well, the context is there's a difference. That's one of the things that the Direct Action Statute 632.24 does, is establish direct liability also. In my hypothetical, you could not maintain a cause of action against the insured, the tortfeasor, because the statute of limitations had run. But if you had filed against the insurance company, and only against the insurance company, prior to the running of the 3-year period, the insurance company could be liable even though its insured is not liable. And I give that because I think there may be a difference between liability and negligence, and you don't want to necessarily make them the same, because conceptually they're different. And you indicated that in your statement that in order for the insurance company to be liable, the insured must be liable. And I just gave you a hypothetical where that's not true.
Well, it does in the sense that in your hypothetical, you still have to prove when you litigate against the insurer who you elected to sue, instead of also joining the insurer.
You still have to prove negligence.
You still have to prove negligence.
No problem. There's a difference.
But you have to prove it, the negligence by the insureds.
Absolutely.
You have to prove they were liable as well.
But in your example, Justice Bradley, there wasn't a timely answer by the insurance denying negligence. There wasn't a timely joining of issue on the issue in the case of negligence. We agree. If Pick alone had been sued here, not the insureds, no timely answer disputing negligence, and Pick hadn't answered, we lose. The question is where they elect on their own to sue both. And the insureds, whose behavior is what's at issue, timely answer, timely dispute negligence, litigated for a year before it's even noticed by the Autos Council, that's a different context. And here, interestingly, if you look at that timely answer that was filed here, the unusual, I kind of started off trying to talk about why this case is a little different, because here, the council for PIC and the insureds is required to provide a joint defense under Chapter 655. It was hired by PIC after coverage was tendered. Its council was paid by PIC for the year. It was providing this adequate defense. And it put in a timely answer, which is in our appendix at P167, a timely answer to the amended complaint when PIC got joined, which in the dealt with the only paragraph that went right at PIC. And in the answer, which is at page 167 of my appendix, it says, deny that Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin is liable to the plaintiffs for any damages, whether or not enumerated in plaintiff's amended complaint. It goes on to dispute every single allegation about PIC. That's
Spence,
a very unusual posture of a case where a defendant doesn't answer. Yes, Justice.
Ben Sicklin, let me ask you this. You're not disputing, or PIC is not disputing, that it has a duty to defend in this case. Is that correct?
Correct, and it did.
All right. Well, here's the problem that I see with your argument. If we adopt the position that you take, wouldn't that allow PIC and conceivably other insurance companies the opportunity to, through the back door, avoid that duty to defend?
I don't think so, because in two respects, Your Honor. One is that, and I was trying to get my answer to Justice Abraham's early question, what is the consequences, even if the answer inures? I think the care, and in the cases that we've cited talk about, there's really two potential consequences. One is that the insurer is deemed to have admitted coverage. It can't dispute that. That's the one allegation that's directly at its position, not a dependent position. Secondly, to the extent, which didn't happen here, there's any prejudice to the plaintiff from the default or not answering, the court has discretion to enter any kind of monetary sanctions or the like to deal with the consequences. But if
coverage.
They hadn't defended at all, Your Honor, if they hadn't, the doctors call up PIC and say, hey, we just got sued, we have a policy with you, and PIC doesn't go out and hire a lawyer to provide a defense and the like, then PIC can be sued for bad faith, and there's a whole body of law about that. But here, that's not what happened. The lawyer was hired, vigorously disputed everything in both the original answer, amended answer, litigated for a year, every issue in this case. And again, 806.02, our default statute, I think is a good touchstone. It says the court may enter default, but only if issue of fact or law hasn't been joined. And that's when you go to this whole body of cases, and I know, you know, Justice Crooks, you said you're not persuaded by it, but there's not a single case in any jurisdiction we could find from the beginning of reported case law where a party whose liability is dependent, whether it's insurer, borrower, guarantor, respondeat superior, any of those contexts where the dependent party, like the insurer, defaults, it's held liable where the party who's directly at issue in the case vigorously disputes the allegations. To adopt the Otto's position, I respectfully submit, would be to make Wisconsin the only jurisdiction, state or federal, which would reject the common defense rule in the context we have here where you have dependent liability. It would be the only case either side could find where that's ever happened. We can find a legion of cases that deal with dependent liability in this situation where the dependent party defendant defaults. We can find all sorts of cases on just joint liability in the common defense point of view. Again, no exceptions. In the Froh federal context.
Counsel, okay. Let me, if I might, stop you right there. My understanding is that the trial court, the circuit judge here, dismissed all of the other defendants except PIC. And my guess is, and it's just a guess at this point, is that he probably took that action so that he was being consistent with the Martin case. Is that significant as we try to weigh all of this?
I think the stipulated order is interesting, Justice Crooks, and it came out different than Martin. I mean, Martin, the only consequence of the insurer's default there was it was deemed to be liable for the coverage. But here, what happened is I got called, I wasn't even counsel yet for PIC by the trial court, and asked to comment about this motion or idea of dismissing the doctors. This is after he's already found PIC, you know, liable, unexcused for default. He's already rejected the argument about the remedy should be limited. He's already setting the matter for a damage trial. He decides, with support from the Ottos, to dismiss the doctors without prejudice. And if you look at the stipulation, it's very interesting. It's in the appendix at 129 to 134. By stipulated order, he says that it's agreed that the record that no finding has been made as to whether any of the provider defendants, that's the doctors, were negligent or demonstrated unprofessional conduct in their previously filed answers to the original and amended complaints stand unaffected by the stipulation on this order. I submit there's no other case ever reported where you have this kind of an odd consequence where you have the dependent defendant party, the insurer, held liable for the acts of the parties who still today have never you know, been found, their answer still stands, disputing all these allegations.
The counselor wasn't, I mean, if you just look at it from a common sense standpoint, the trial court's ruling on a matter of first impression, he doesn't want to prejudice the plaintiff's rights against the doctors if they have a very valid malpractice claim. But yet he wants to go forward with how he thinks the law is or should be in Wisconsin. So the stipulation appears to permit a reinstitution of the claims against the doctors if, in fact, you prevail before us, for example. And there has to be liability proven before PIC or any of the other insurers is on the hook. I mean, isn't that kind of what it accomplishes?
Well, I'm not faulting the doctor's desire, you know, not to be deemed to have been negligent here in this context. However,
well, it's not so much their desire as you know, I mean, they don't want to admit liability, but the plaintiffs don't want to lose their claim for relief either.
Except in paragraph 2 of the stipulation on page appendix page 130, plaintiffs covenant that neither they nor their successors, et cetera, shall commence any action against the health care providers. You know, before the expiration of the applicable limitation period. They waived that right in paragraph 2 to sue later. What I think what happened with the stipulation, Your Honor, is that the trial court had to go to this kind of tortured, unusual procedure as a consequence of trying to somehow reconcile the fact that you had inconsistent outcomes here, which is what Froh and all these common defense courts say is the problem at the bottom here. And simply,
in a direct action state like this, you don't need a judgment against the doctors, so that it's not inconsistent here. It is totally consistent.
How is it any different, Your Honor, than like the Nevada case that we cite and discuss, or any of these dependent liability cases?
But you talk about dependent liability. Is that the same as derivative?
It's basically in.
Is that the same as derivative? I mean, that's usually the language used. Or are you trying to avoid some of our derivative cases?
I'm not trying to avoid it. I'm not sure it's exactly the same. A derivative has a meaning all its own in some
context. I know,
context.
Which is not quite clear. Mm-hmm. And dependent is not usually used, so I think that's probably as unclear.
Okay.
But we can clarify that.
But in the Paul case from Nevada, where the Supreme Court there, the court talks about, just like in our situation, the plaintiff didn't have to sue both, you know, the minor and the stepfather, but it elected to do it. And it says, you know, here respondent chose to join appellant, the father, in the same action. And then it goes on and says it made that choice, and there was a timely answer disputing the liability of the primary party, the son, it inures to the benefit of the father.
This concept of one defendant, who has a similar interest or the same interest as another defendant, and that the one that answers inures to the benefit of the one that doesn't answer, is a doctrine that's been recognized outside the state. I don't dispute that with you.
And if we get to the direct action statute, the closest case in Wisconsin, I submit, is your decision, this court's decision, in the Hagen case, where it's not really a default case, but the court says it's a direct action case, and we discussed it at some length in our brief, and the insured filed a timely affirmative defense, which the insurer didn't, and after the time ran where it could, it wished to take the benefit of that, and this court held that the timely answer with the affirmative defense by its insureds inured to the benefit of the insurer, because under our direct action statute, the liability of the insurer is derivative, dependent, however you want to express it. That's the closest case we could find by this court, and I think that's significant. Now,
counsel? Was coverage ever contested in this case? Is coverage of any moment in this case?
No. The answer that PIC's lawyer timely put in for the insurers that I read you, the first sentence is paragraph 6, PIC denies any liability. The second one is it admits coverage.
Okay, so
what's the consequence? Defaults are not good. They are bad. People should timely answer things. What's the consequence here for this insurer or any other insurers who decide not to answer when coverage isn't an issue? If the only consequence to default is there's coverage, period.
I do see a red light, but may I answer?
You may respond.
Okay, thank you. I think there's several. One is that there may well have been a coverage issue here. I mean, it could have been hung on that, but it wasn't.
Well, in reality, I didn't see anything that gave smell to me of any coverage question. Was there?
No, there was. Yeah. It admitted coverage flat out.
Okay,
but it did several things. One is you still have to provide the full vigorous defense, file a timely answer disputing all of the allegations. Your costs are probably identical either way. There's really no incentive not to defend if you're filing a timely answer and litigating everything for your insurance.
What's the incentive to even answer? That's really what I'm getting to.
What's the consequence? I think the incentive is if the Ottos here had ever claimed, which they didn't, or the trial court had ever found one scintilla of prejudice to them from the PIC not answering, the trial court has ample latitude under both 80602 or the procedural default statute, 80503, to impose any kind of appropriate sanction, monetary sanction. You know, if they had to bring a motion, they got delayed, whatever it might be, the court has ample discretion to craft an appropriate sanction short of denying PIC the opportunity to defend itself on the merits in court. And that's always the case where a party engages in any kind of a procedural default or the like. You look at what was the prejudice, and you try to craft a fair solution. I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all situation.
If you lost that prejudice argument in the courts below, though, right, with regard not to the general procedural sanction statute, but with regard to 80602, the default judgment.
The Insurance Association Amicus goes through an interesting analysis of it, and we lost it in the sense that Judge Hoover and the Court of Appeals felt that if you find excusable neglect or lack of excusable neglect first, you don't get to the interests of justice. And we got off into a whole tangent as a result, and we chose for purposes of this petition to focus on what I think is the more significant issue, which is in the context of all derivative or dependent liability situations with multiple defendants, where you dispute, where the issue is joined on the merits of the behavior at issue. Here, were the doctors negligent in treating Mr. Phelps? That's the core issue that was joined. That's what we focused on in this case.
Justice Prosser has a question.
I have a couple of questions, Mr. Van Sicklin. As I understand it, in a medical malpractice case under the direct action statute, the insurer can be named, but the insured do not have to be named. Is that right?
Yes.
If there is a trial and liability is found, what happens under 75330 sub 4? Does the clerk of court report to the medical examining board the liability or negligence of the doctors?
Well, this was something that was discussed at the oral argument before the trial court on this remedy issue, at which point PIC accommodated the doctors had separate counsel from Quarles and Brady and expressed their concern about the inconsistent outcome issue. And if PIC was deemed to be liable for the negligence of the doctors, would that be reported? And I think that's one of the reasons we evolved into this stipulated order that tried to protect the doctors. If in fact, PIC alone was named and you had a trial on the merits, or PIC and the doctors were named and you had a trial on the merits that resulted in a judgment, it would be reported to the professional association that monitors that and tracks that for the medical profession under that statute.
So what you're saying here is that this sort of a stipulation would allow, arguably, or at least put hypothetically, negligent doctors to avoid having their names forwarded to the medical examining board. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now let me ask you this. Could a circuit judge have declined to enter default judgment on the facts of this case?
I believe so at any one of the steps. It could have found that there really wasn't a default because the answer said PIC denies, you know, or the answer said that PIC is not liable for any of the actions of the doctor, or could have granted excusable neglect, or could have granted what we requested on the remedy.
But you haven't raised any of those issues before this court. I mean, is everyone else in the world who faces similar facts going to be bound by these cases now because you haven't raised them in this court?
No, I think this court has a very developed set of case law dealing with what's default, what's excusable neglect, you know, whether or not prejudice has to be demonstrated as a part of the interest of justice component. All of that's well developed in this court. What has never been addressed directly is this issue that we have here of what's the remedy where you have the primary defendant timely putting at issue all of the issues in the case and the dependent derivative co-defendant defaults. And so that's what we're trying to seek guidance on here. The other issues are probably more factual in nature. You know, what are the facts and circumstances regarding the excusable neglect claim and the like? And here, I submit that this is a de novo issue of law. What's the legal answer to this situation where you, it's a very unusual situation where you have timely issue joined by the parties that are, whose conduct's at issue. And that's what we're seeking relief on. And so I think the type of remedy that you hopefully can and will craft is to deal with the issue that we have here. And I don't see why you would need to, you're not blessing the behavior that happened earlier in terms of whether it was excusable neglect or not. I don't know if that.
Counsel, other than this case and this fact situation, where else do you get a partial default judgment? That's what you're asking for, a partial default judgment. We default as to coverage, so we are responsible. We don't default as to our liability. Now, the default judgment admits liability. That's the whole point of a default judgment. And that there's still a proceeding on damages, which you had. Was there a demand for jury trial here?
There was, I think, as I recall, but it was tried to the court, the damage phase.
The damage phase was
because
tried to the court.
At that point, the court had restricted PIC's rights as
okay.
a party. But to answer your question.
Right. But that's a partial, what you're really asking for is a partial default judgment. One issue is coverage, the other is liability. You're willing to agree that there's a default on coverage. You're not willing to agree there's a default on liability.
I think it's really more in keeping with the spirit of this court's decisions in cases like Hedke and the like, which deal with default, where you say that you have a whole, you know, quiver of different, you know, arrows you can shoot at the defendant when they fail to file a timely answer. And here, you don't have where a defendant fails to answer timely. You don't have to default them. You've held that.
You can impose
monetary sanctions.
You're conceding default on coverage.
On the only issue that was pled against the party where issue arguably wasn't joined by it. I think you could construe paragraph 6 as joining issue on that.
I have another question. PIC is mentioned in that original answer, although the lawyer, it's not appears elsewhere other than in the body. Where else did the counsel represent PIC directly and clearly on the record?
Both sides have pointed to there's inconsistencies. There are a variety of occasions where he filed something that just said, you know, counsel for defendants, which until the fund got dismissed, also included the fund here as part of the adequate joint defense under 655. There are other occasions where PIC was specifically mentioned. As I mentioned in the reply brief, the Otto's counsel chose to direct correspondence, their offer of settlement at all, notices of deposition to Attorney DuBose as PIC's counsel.
Even though he was not PIC's counsel.
Well, his own affidavit says he was PIC's counsel, but the answer, we don't dispute that his answer didn't put the name Physicians
okay.
Insurance Company.
Gotcha.
But there's mixed signals in the documents, which
if I may, just to
Bradley.
Thank you, Chief. Just to clarify, did DuBose make any filings other than the amended answer filed in November of 2003, referencing its representation of PIC?
Well, certainly thereafter he did, and I don't recall off. I can't stand here and quote one. I don't recall one. I do recall the plaintiffs submitting things to
yes,
him
I
as
know.
Counsel.
Let me do two time frames. From the time that it filed an answer, DuBose filed an answer of November 2003 until an answer was formally filed for PIC in August of 2004. Is there any pleading or paper filed that indicates filed by DuBose, indicating DuBose's representation of PIC from November 2003 to August 2004?
Not that I recall.
From August 2004 until the time that the default judgment was entered, which I believe the motion for default, which is in December of 2004, was there any pleading? I suppose then the pleadings would
all
be.
All of the
because,
records
yeah,
properly.
Yeah, then they would be. Yeah, thank
and
you.
Many of the documents, his typical thing was to answer as counsel for defendants. So mm-hmm. it wasn't that he always just listed them all and then neglected yeah. physicians. And the only yeah. earlier document, Justice Bradley, is where he wrote the Otto's counsel after getting the original complaint and said, mm-hmm. The primary carrier here for the defendants is Physicians Insurance Company. And the Otto's then sent him the courtesy copy of the amended complaint, the only difference being from the original complaint that it added, it changed XYZ insurance to PIC. So there was no secret about, you know, the fact that the attorney should have answered or included PIC's name on that. But I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank
I'm
you,
sorry
Mr. Van Sicklen.
To counsel for so much time there.
You're going to have to come back anyway. Just for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Straka, representing the estate of Dale Otto.
Thank you, Your Honor, Court, and Counsel. My name is Heath Straka, and I do represent the plaintiff respondents, the Ottos, in this matter. I think this case, after I've heard some more argument from Mr. Van Sicklen and having read his briefs and been involved in this case since the very beginning, that it comes down to two things, and it comes down to responsibility and it comes down to consequence. I tell my 5-year-old all the time that he has certain responsibilities in life. He's got to return library books on time or there's going to be a consequence. And in this case, PIC had a responsibility to answer the amended complaint. There's no dispute there. It's not an issue here. They've admitted that. And there has to be a consequence for that. And the consequence that this trial court, in its discretion, decided to enter was a default judgment. And actually, in its discretion, decided two things. First, PIC had an opportunity to explain why it was late. It failed to utter one breath regarding why its neglect was excusable. PIC didn't submit any affidavits. PIC didn't interject anything. The only thing that we see regarding excusable neglect is an affidavit from Attorney DuBose explaining a typographical error. The same typographical error, but then occurred 13 more times. And Justice Bradley, to answer your question of Mr. Van Sicklen, there were no other pleadings filed by Mr. DuBose typo wherein he specifically indicated that he was filing that pleading on behalf of PIC, Physicians Insurance Company. And the reason that's important is the trial court specifically asked Mr. DeBow during oral argument, did PIC ever direct you to answer this amended complaint? And he pointedly said no. I can point to nothing in my file, Your Honor, he said, where PIC instructed me to answer that complaint.
Counselor, I think they've conceded that there isn't excusable neglect, at least before us. I'm very interested in how you see the direct action statute's implication here. And do you think it's relevant to your case or not at all?
Absolutely, I think it's relevant.
How so?
I think it's relevant for this, Your Honor. In Wisconsin, and as I pointed out in our brief and Mr. Wagensicklin argued, we are only one of two states that have a direct action like Wisconsin's, where you don't have to first obtain a judgment against an insured before proceeding against the insurance company.
Don't you have to prove liability against the insured under the statute?
You have to, no, not to proceed directly against PIC. You have to get, especially in this case, because I think we're talking about two different things, and I think
I'm talking about trying to collect money against PIC. I think that's where we are in this case, really. Are they going to have to pay up or not? I mean, that's what I see it as.
And I think so, because I think it's a sanction for their failing to answer, and a sanction that in the Split Rock case specifically said
that authorized. May all be true, but let's keep on the direct action statute for just a little bit, because I'm concerned about the fact, I know we're only one of two states, and so of course that doesn't give us a whole lot of law to look back on. And I guess I want to know, do you have to, if you had sued PIC and didn't sue any of the doctors, would you had to have proved the doctor's liability in order to collect from PIC?
If we had gone all the way through to a trial, yes. If PIC had not answered the complaint, they would have deemed to admit the liability, ergo you're proving it, which is what happened in this case.
No, but what I'm saying to you is if you sued, hypothetical, you just sued PIC, you didn't sue any of the docs, which you can do under the statute, correct?
Correct.
Okay. If you did that, would you have had to prove negligence and causation on behalf of the doctors in order to get liability before you could collect from PIC?
Yes.
Okay. So you agree that liability has to be established for the doctor's conduct before PIC is obligated to pay?
On the merits, yes.
Okay. Now, in this case, it's a little bit different because you're asking for recompense against PIC without having proved liability on behalf of the doctors, correct?
I think the liability was proved by their deeming to admit the allegation of liability.
The docs didn't admit the allegations of liability, did they? I thought they denied
No, the
it.
Doctors did not, Your Honor, but right. I think where we are with that is
okay.
That PIC has admitted that they didn't interpose an answer. That issue isn't being argued by them. And the statutes, I think, on this issue are pretty clear. They had to answer, and when they're, since they did not prove excusable neglect, and the reason I bring that up is because under 801.15 in Split Rock, you have to join issue, and joining issue requires two things. One, you have to timely serve an answer, and then file it with the court within a reasonable time. And I think, Justice Prosser, this was your decision, and the difference there is when you fail to serve within the statutory time period, a serious sanction can be imposed, and it's a discretionary sanction. Whereas if you fail to file the answer with the court within a reasonable time, perhaps a less serious sanction is appropriate. And I think that's the heart of what Split Rock says on that issue.
Yeah, I'm not concerned so much with that. I'm concerned with getting liability against the insurance company for the doctor's conduct when the doctors have joined issue on liability. And I guess if I understand your argument, maybe I'm not understanding it, but if I understand your argument, what you're saying is the failure of PIC to answer negated the doctor's denial of liability. And since I could have sued them anyway, this is like I didn't sue the doctors at all once PIC stopped the action here by not answering. then the part of the lawsuit where I sued the doctors just falls away. And all we have left is as though I'd started a direct actions liability claim against PIC, and they didn't answer. Is that right? Is that what you're doing?
I think you've caught the heart of it, Your Honor, okay. Or Justice, in that, but we did start a direct action against PIC by naming them as a proper party defendant and pled that they were directly liable.
But you also named the doctors, though, and,
yes.
And the only way you can, I mean, the claims against the doctors were all dismissed, so now you're standing as though you had only sued PIC and PIC didn't answer, right?
Correct.
Okay. I'm trying to get my head around it. Thank
Counsel,
you.
I have in front of me the amended complaint, which was filed in the court on October 30th, 2003, date stamped in Dunn County, and that names PIC. And it has a lot of allegations here, a lot of allegations regarding first cause of action, medical negligence. Second cause of action, medical negligence. These are all factual allegations. Third cause of action is an informed consent, et cetera.
Justice Bradley, this appears also for the rest of the court in the appendix at 154, so we can follow along. Go ahead.
Thank you. So everything that is in this document is on the default judgment because the answer was struck. Everything is admitted. Every fact asserted is admitted. Every averment is admitted. Is that correct?
That's correct under 802.02, Your Honor, and the case law that has interpreted that going back some time.
Then, counsel, the doctors are deemed negligent. The clerk of courts will forward that to the medical examining board. And I'm kind of hearkening back to Justice Prosser's question earlier. I mean, the doctors have to be negligent for PIC to be liable, right? Because that's what you're saying, that's where their liability stems from. In the complaint, it alleges negligence. PIC is liable because of the doctor's negligence, because that's deemed admitted, true?
True, and directly liable.
Okay, so the doctors don't need to be included at all. They could have PIC say they're liable, they never have a chance to defend themselves, and that's it. Liability is established because PIC decides to admit their liability.
I think the difference here, though, is that there isn't a jury finding, there isn't a finding by the jury indicating that the doctors violated the standard of care. What this court did was enter a default judgment, and as a sanction,
default comes from the words in the complaint.
True,
and the
exactly.
fact that they're deemed admitted, and the words in the complaint are that the doctors are negligent.
Correct.
So that's where the liability comes from, doesn't it?
The liability comes from their failure to answer, ergo they admit everything. Right.
Right, but if failure to answer didn't mean anything in the law, and it didn't have to, I mean, you know, you have to answer something, and that is the complaint. And failure to answer means that what's in the complaint is deemed admitted.
Right.
So PIC is admitting the doctor's liability and negligence, and their liability then stems from that, according to your logic, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Which...
I'm trying to just reconcile the words of the statute, the direct action against the insurer, because this is a little quirky. I mean, this is a little unusual to have an answer that really does deny, and then they weren't even served, so that really doesn't mean anything, and then they don't timely answer, and then having been a circuit court judge, I think entering default is completely appropriate if someone waits 8 months to timely file an answer, and I don't think we ought to for the rule that, you know, you can wait forever and you can sit on your hands and you don't have to follow the rules that everyone else has to follow and you don't have to answer. On the other hand, in a direct action lawsuit, it stems from the negligence of the doctors. So I just want to be clear that in this determination, this court is also, or the lower courts also essentially made the finding that the doctors were negligent, according to your logic.
Yeah, and if I could follow up on that point, because I think you're right, but also in Chapter 655, this is talked about in terms of at 655, I think it's .245, parent 1, that the a liability insurer, in this case PIC, has a statutory authority to either settle a case or not, irrespective of what the doctors think. So the doctors may very well want their day in court, may want to prove that they weren't negligent, but it doesn't matter. If the liability insurer says, nope, we're going to settle this,
but
and
this,
the plaintiff...
This isn't a settlement. This is a determination on the facts of the complaint that they're deemed admitted. That is, the negligence is admitted.
Yes, but under a settlement, it still, I believe, gets reported
well,
under
753. Well, you're just saying the failure to answer is in effect a settlement. I'm going to settle for anything I owe you.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
what... The failure to answer. Your argument, you keep talking about a settlement. You're then equating failure to answer and default as a settlement, saying I'm going to take whatever I have to once damages are decided. Isn't that what the default here was? I mean, that's your argument.
Yeah, once the default is entered under 80602, and
right.
Once a default judgment is granted in this discretion, the next step is the hearing on damages.
Counsel, default is the same in your mind as a settlement because you're just agreeing there's liability.
I'm not trying to say that it's the same as a settlement in all circumstances. I guess I was trying to address Justice Ziegler's question with respect to what gets reported about the doctors.
You're trying to say that the PIC had authority to declare the doctors negligent, or that PIC can, without declaring the doctors negligent on the record, can just default.
Correct.
Okay.
Counsel, I return where I started with my question on the word of liability, because it seems to me people are talking about different things with regard to liability. Some, on one occasion during this oral argument, liability was used synonymously with you're responsible to pay the money. You're liable for it. You got to pay the money. Liability insurance carrier was talked about here too, which in part is you're responsible and you got to pay the money. You're responsible for paying the money. Liability has also been used synonymously here for the words of negligence and causation. So when the averments of this complaint are deemed admitted, the averments are negligence and causation. But who is liable to pay the money under the direct action statute here? That's both substantive and procedural.
The judgment, and that's why you bring the physician's insurance company into the case. It's Wisconsin's direct action statute is not an indemnification agreement. The insured never pays anything, so therefore it's not indemnification. What PIC, you can get a judgment against PIC, and they pay the injured plaintiff directly. They don't go through the insured.
So this is a judgment, because everything here is admitted that this complaint, amended complaint, is true. The negligence of the doctors is admitted. The causation for the injury vis-a-vis the negligence is admitted. And with the direct action statute, the insurance company can be held directly liable and sued exclusively, if
correct.
Desired.
Counselor, what if we have the same facts we have now, but one of the docs, for whatever reason, never saw this patient. This is a screw-up in the medical records, and they thought it was Dr. Witt and the guy, and so that's who got sued, and then really it was Dr. Witty who should have been sued. This doctor didn't see the patient at all. And can, in a direct action where you don't name the docs, can the insurance company admit liability on behalf of that doctor?
I would answer it this way, Justice. I think what in that hypothetical, what would happen is there would be a motion to vacate. Similarly to the oral argument you all heard in January in the Larry versus Harris case.
Right.
And to correct something where you have a non-proper party defendant, someone who was never involved. And I think that's the issue that this court took up, whether the circuit court could sua sponte grant a motion to vacate, because it was clear in that case that the one police officer who entered into the home wasn't the one who entered into the home. So that would be the appropriate time to raise a meritorious defense. The meritorious defense doesn't even enter the fray under 80115, 80209, or the default judgment statute. It only enters the fray if a motion to vacate is moved for, and it was never done in this case.
Okay. Thank you.
But could I ask, I'm honestly not clear on whether the clerk of circuit court has to advise the medical examining board about these two doctors.
Nor am I, Your Honor, because that hasn't been an issue. It was an issue that was dropped. It was not appealed, and it wasn't before this court. And so it dovetails with when I was trying to answer Justice Ziegler's question regarding the doctors aren't getting their chance to defend themselves. And when you look under 655, there are other circumstances in which the doctors wouldn't get that chance. Because of the direct action statute, because Prick is a proper party defendant without a judgment ever being – it can be a proper party defendant without a judgment first being secured against the insured. That's what makes Wisconsin different.
Well, if the clerk calls you up, counsel, and says, shall I advise the medical examining board, what will your advice be?
That I will look at Chapter 753 – and research that to determine if that is indeed what needs to happen.
Is that your obligation, counsel?
So there
you
attorney.
I don't know.
Next question, Your Honor.
Well, if the clerk calls and asks, it's probably because the judge asked the clerk to ask, so I think I would have an obligation, yes.
Do it on the record, counsel.
Could I ask this question? Could you outline the total damages in this case?
Could I outline the total damages in this case? Sure. They're delineated, I believe, in the material that was forwarded to you, I believe, in our brief. But this was a failure to diagnose a medical negligence case regarding esophageal cancer.
How much money is supposed to be paid?
Well, I'd have to look to see what the breakdown is, but an amount of money awarded for conscious pain and suffering, living, having the disease metastasize.
Well, there's 800 some thousand dollars.
Yeah, over 900.
Okay. What else is there?
Then the interest regarding the offer of settlement, because it was exceeded, and costs.
Interest from when?
Interest from the time that the judgment was entered. Or you go back, I'm sorry, to when the offer was made.
Offer is made to the time of judgment?
It's still accruing.
Oh, it's still accruing. Okay. But there were a number of months between the time the court issued an order of default and the time of judgment. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
How many months were there?
We went on the record in February of 2005. I tried to do the math in my head here. There was no decision at that time. A written decision came down on, I believe, June 10th, 2005, finding Pick in default. The hearing on damages went forward in September because that's when the court had set aside the time for the jury trial. And then the judgment was entered either late in 2005 or early of 2006, I believe December of 2005, delineating how much on each line.
And when was the final judgment from the circuit court entered?
It would be shortly thereafter. And then it was appealed from a notice of entry, I believe, was done.
And interest is being charged all the time. I mean,
correct.
Is that delay excusable neglect on the part of the court?
No. Because there's a body of case law that it has already talked about when that interest starts to run, when it stops.
But I mean, never mind.
To answer your question, are you asking, is the delay from the time the court thought of that it was going to enter default, hearing on damages, final judgment, is that delay excusable neglect? No.
By the court?
Correct. I believe that was the question, right?
Maybe we're talking past each
other. Okay, I'm sorry.
There was a fairly lengthy delay between the time of the default and the time of the final judgment. And you want interest on all of that.
Correct.
Okay. And if the court is sitting around not acting properly, the interest is charged to pick. Isn't that right?
If the court was sitting around not acting properly, or if the court has a docket that they're trying, whatever the delay is, yes, the interest would be charged to pick.
Your client made an offer of settlement for $500,000, is my memory right?
I believe your memory is correct.
Okay, and they ultimately, on the damage hearing, got $800,000 or thereabouts.
Right.
And there's a statute that says if your offer of settlement was not taken and you get more than the offer of settlement, then you are entitled to X, Y, and Z.
Correct.
And then you're just going under the statute.
Exactly.
And nobody's debating the amount of damages. Is there? I didn't see that.
So no debate.
That's not the fight.
No.
The fight here is whether any damages should have been assessed at this stage of the proceeding, right?
Correct.
Okay. So our focus is whether you have to vacate that default judgment, this court. That's what the defendant is asking for, right? And remand the case for a hearing on PIC's liability, not Dr. Fogelstad's liability or Red Cedar Clinic or the Mayo Health System or the Patient's Compensation Fund. They're out.
Correct.
Okay. That's what your understanding of the remedy?
Oh, I'm sorry to cut. In a sense, they're arguing for a motion to vacate, but that motion was never made. That would be basically to have any effect, that's what have to have happened. But a motion to vacate to be granted, it's two-pronged. They have to prove excusable neglect and a meritorious defense. And you have a year to make that motion to vacate. It was never made. And the PIC would have had another year to put something before the court to show the court why its neglect was excusable. Never did.
I use the word vacate. They use the word reverse. Not much different.
Oh, true.
Okay.
Counselor, if you were not to prevail here, just assume, and we said, no, you can't get damages without a further hearing on liability, would you be able to reinstitute your claims against the doctors under the stipulation and judgment? Attorney Van Sicklin read me a paragraph, and I hadn't looked at it that way initially, but it sounds to me like maybe that claim is gone. What would you do if you were sent back down to the trial court?
Proceed directly against PIC.
Okay, so you wouldn't have to name the doctors, but you'd still have to prove their liability for malpractice, correct?
Correct.
I see. Okay, I understand better now. Thank you.
My green light is still on, and I was waiting for another question.
Tell me why you think you should win.
How's that
for an opener? Okay? Well, look, the court, and Mr. Van Sicklin stated this correctly, default judgments are not favored in the law. We give them because we have to keep moving cases. We can't have people ignore the procedure and just sit around, and then when they're good and ready, they say, whoops, open it all up again, right?
Correct.
So they're not favored. And here you have a default judgment. You not only have a default judgment, you got it in a lot of money, right? Almost $1 million.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
Maybe a little more than $1 million by the time we finish here?
Correct.
Okay. And yet the patient's compensation fund, will PIC be able to cover if it's over $1 million?
Yes.
Their liability ends at $1 million.
That's true. But because it was PIC's conduct that caused it, and to get over that $1 million, it's interest costs.
Right.
Yes, they would have the coverage.
They're
to
liable
for.
Anyway,
yes.
Even if it's in excess of the policy.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
So why should you win when default judgments aren't favored? You got $1 million here? I mean, that's a lot of scratch, even for PIC, right?
Sure.
All right.
But, I mean, I don't think we're talking about whether it's a $1, $1,000, or $1 million. The fact of the matter is they have a statutory obligation to answer amended complaints. 802.09 couldn't be any more clear. It says that a party shall answer an amended complaint. They didn't do it. They get a kick at the cat to say, wait, we get a motion to enlarge time under 801.15. And if we can prove to you, court, that it was because of excusable neglect, we get a little bit more time. They shirk that responsibility, too. Then, and that's discretionary, then the judge, the trial court judge, has another round of discretion. Okay, well, they don't have an answer here. And they don't have an answer because they failed to timely serve. And as we said in Split Rock, that sanction can be serious. And it's a sanction that has been contemplated under the statutes, which I think was under is what the dissent said in Split Rock, which was written by Justice Wilcox and joined by Justice Crooks. It said the defendant violated the rules of civil procedure, and the court imposed a sanction it was authorized by statute to impose. The statutes in Wisconsin are clear. There's no ambiguity in them. You must answer, or you must approve excusable neglect when you don't answer on time. And it's the trial court has discretion then to enter a default judgment. There's not another round of, well, what does the default mean? There's no statute that says, well, PIC just admits coverage. There's no dispute there. There's no, this isn't some sort of economic loss doctrine issue or anything else. There's clearly coverage. Okay, so the fact of the matter is PIC decided not to allow its counsel to accept service, made the plaintiffs go through the pomp and circumstance of serving Penny O'Hare, the vice president, claims personally. That triggered a duty. The duty was to answer. You know, and it, the way the PIC has framed this issue is it appropriate? Somehow begging for this isn't fair. We heard a lot about prejudice in Mr. Van Sicklin's argument, even though that issue is not before this court. They've already disposed of that. It may not be fair, but it's just. There's a lot of things in the law that aren't fair. If in the medical malpractice arena, you have 180 days to file a notice of claim against the state doc, usually at the UW. If the patient doesn't even know that exists and comes to me on the 181st day, they're out. That statute is clear. It's unambiguous. It's been strictly construed. How do you change it? You go to the legislator, and you have someone write a bill. In that case, it's a family justice bill. And that's being heard and that's being talked about, whether that statute should be changed. That, if PIC thinks this is so unfair that they have to answer a complaint like everyone else, then they can talk to their legislature about crafting anew the statute or changing the statutes. But when the statutes are clear and when they're unambiguous, this court, in its discretion, did what was appropriate. Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. Van Sicklin.
Thank you.
Why the heck did the man not notify the attorney? What was the screw up?
I mean, I know reasons outside the record, and so I want to be fair on that. I mean, what happened here is the courtesy copy of the amended complaint got sent to the lawyer who had just told the Otto's counsel that PIC was the insurer, and he got sent to him because he's required to provide a defense for PIC under Chapter 655. Every one of these Med-Mal cases, the same lawyer represents the insured and the carrier. And should they have communicated better? Yes. But the fundamental oddity of this case is that default was awarded here, $1 million penalty, even though issue was joined and contested. It's a penalty, you know, the point of pleadings is to make sure that issue gets joined. It was joined and hotly contested and litigated for a year with PIC providing the defense through the lawyer. Should the claims adjuster have made sure that PIC's name was on the amended, you know, answer? Yes. And the record's silent beyond that. But
Mr. Van Sicklin, basically, as I understand your argument, it's that as a result of the default, the insurance company should be held for coverage, to be responsible for coverage here, but not for liability.
Correct.
And my question goes to how you square that with the language of the direct action statute itself that says, and I'm going to leave out the portions that aren't applicable, any policy of insurance covering liability to others for negligence makes the insurer liable up to the amount stated in the policy to the persons entitled to recover, irrespective of whether the liability is presently established or is contingent.
We addressed that at quite some length in our reply brief, Justice Butler, and it's interesting because liability is used in two different senses there, and it gets to be a little bit esoteric. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is when you look at Loy Decades Monthly, or you look at the corresponding case in Louisiana that talks about direct action, yes, you can name the insurance carrier directly in the first instance on the grounds that it has a contract and therefore could be found liable, but you still have to prove the liability of the insureds to a judgment. And so I think that liability is used with that sort of dual meaning, as we point out in our footnote in the reply brief, quoting Black's Law Dictionary on that, is that stripping aside everything else about the direct action statute, all it means is it's a convenient tool where the plaintiff can't find the insured. They can sue the insurance carrier directly if they wish. But whereas here, they elected to sue both the insureds and the carrier, and a full, vigorous defense was posed, issue was joined, it's a different situation than counsel just posed where we neglected everything. The carrier...
Let me ask the question then a bit differently.
Okay.
Where in the direct action statute does it state that when there's a default judgment, similar to the one that occurred here, that the effect of the default is coverage?
It's silent about default. It's silent both directions. I don't think it has really anything to add to this inquiry here. It doesn't change the fundamental relationship of derivative-dependent liability that we see in many different contexts in the law. And it's no different than borrower, guarantor, all the other ones we've looked at, respondeat superior. It's the same. You could have sued one or the other. They chose to sue both. If issue hadn't been joined here, we'd lose. I concede that. But here we have something different. And what that drives is this whole body of law that you see in these briefs from every court elsewhere in the country that says, we have a common defense, timely raised, litigated. It wasn't that Pick neglected this case. It hired, paid a lawyer, drove it. It neglected to be sure its name was on the amended complaint. But $1 million penalty for that, where issues joined, that's the point of pleadings, is to make sure issues joined.
Counsel, the direct action statute in several cases, referring to Wisconsin's direct action statute, referenced that it's not only procedural as to who he can sue, but substantive. It sounds to me as though you're focusing on the procedural but not on the substantive. Can you respond to that?
I think the substance is if only the insurer gets sued,
you're liable.
You're liable. I mean, that's substance, all right, and you have to... But beyond that, I'm not sure it's very significant to this issue. I think Justice Prosser asked a question and Chief Justice Abrahamson about partial default and all. I would commend to you the procedure that all of the federal courts used and that's laid out for state courts too, in Amger and Moores and Wright and Miller, where there is the insurer pick here defaults, but the direct parties don't and have a timely answer. What they say should happen is you should go ahead and try the case by the insureds who are timely and vigorously litigating it, and if they prevail, the party that defaulted is off the hook. If they're found liable at that point, you bring back in the defaulting party, and that's how it's done everywhere else in the country, and I think that makes sense here with our direct action statute. I do think it's very consistent with, Loy and Decades Monthly and all these other cases where you have to show that the insureds acted wrongfully. And that wasn't done here, and that's why you have this inconsistent, odd result of a stipulation. saying that they're not found liable. There was some question about settlement. I'll just one last point. The settlement here, I think, is a very different posture. Pick could not settle this case, or any case, by admitting that its insured health care providers were negligent without their approval, where they're vigorously disputing it. That would be bad faith. It can settle a case consensually without admitting fault by any party, but that's a very different situation that happened here. We couldn't force a settlement that admits fault by the doctors if they're disputing it. We must check with them. That would be bad faith. So I hope I've answered your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen. I want to thank both Mr. Van Sicklen and Mr. Straka on behalf of the court for their excellent arguments and excellent brief in an issue of first impression in this court. So on behalf of the court, we say thank you. It's a good note of an oral argument on which to end our oral arguments for this term, which, as you know, we don't have terms anymore, but we still use that expression. So that concludes our hearing in 06-AP-1566, Estate of Otto versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin. If the students will remain in the courtroom, Justice Butler will be out in the presentation. And those in 411 South, Justice Prosser will be up shortly to talk with you all. So let us end as we began with a recognition of Justice Butler and then proceed out.
I will be right out. I'll be right out to talk with the students and anyone else who wants to remain. Okay.